This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us on Talk Louisiana. Signature support is from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services and from Jerry Lane Chevrolet. Podcasts are available for this show anytime, day or night, at WRKF.org and at TalkLouisiana.org. And the show re-airs at 9 p.m. every Monday through Friday. We start our week with Karen Roy, who is a heroic member of our community. 35 years ago tonight, after LSU pummeled Rice in Tiger Stadium, she and her boyfriend went out to the legendary night spot Tabby's Blues Box on North Boulevard. Unfortunately for Karen, she ended up shot and paralyzed, and she has been with us before on anniversaries, and this is number 35, and we want to talk with her about her amazing life, which continues, and of course, as you can imagine, there are challenges related to what occurred 35 years ago this evening. Now, this is in the same area of town, a few blocks away, really, to be precise, from where Allison Rice, who was a 21-year-old student at LSU, died at about 2:30 in the morning, Friday morning, when she was shot inside her car several times. It appears, based on discussions with people who are investigating, that this was a carjacking incident, but we really don't know the particulars, and the assailants are at large. So if anyone has information, we certainly advise you to contact the authorities. A senseless killing of a 21-year-old girl who was set to graduate in May, a marketing major from Geismar who was working her way through college and ended up losing her life far too young and for nothing, absolutely nothing. And speaking of that, it's very similar to what happened to you, Karen Roy. The assailants who approached you really after what amounted to nothing, but they almost took your life, but they didn't take your spirit.
Yeah, my heart goes out to Allison's family and her friends. And obviously Baton Rouge is a big, small town. And my kids, you know, had friends. She worked at a restaurant with my son's girlfriend. And it's tragic. And it's, of course, it did make everyone think about 35 years ago. As Jim said, I went to the LSU Rice football game. My boyfriend played guitar and had made plans to play music that night at Tabby's. There was a long conversation about how I didn't want to go. I'd never been there before. And, but not just that, it was sort of just a general feeling of not really wanting to go out. I went anyway, cause I've made the joke before. If you let your hot guitar playing boyfriend go to the bar by himself, you may not have that hot boyfriend anymore. So I made the choice to go, and we were trying to leave, and we didn't know it, but there were three kids, with guns. My car had been broken into, so we stopped for a second to deal with the break-in, and I said, I guess we should call the police. And then someone came up from behind me, hit me over the, well, grabbed my shoulders, took my purse with my $2 in it, hit me over the head with the gun. There was a gunman on the other side of the car that put the gun to my boyfriend's head. They struggled for control of the gun. So after the robber had my purse with my $2 in it, there was some scuffling on the other side, and one of the kids screamed to his friend, shoot him, Dodie, shoot him. And we think he meant for him to shoot Mike, because I was already bleeding. But instead he put the gun in my back and pulled the trigger point blank, leaving me with a punctured lung, almost bled to death, and a T10 complete spinal cord injury.
And you have heroically come back from that, but that night lives on. You remember it so vividly, and for good reason. The boyfriend was Mike Shacatano, right?
Yes.
The son of the legendary wrestling coach at LSU, Larry Shacatano.
Larry Shacatano.
And you remained close for many years after that. Almost got married, didn't you?
Almost got married 5 years after. We didn't. We remain really good friends. He lives in Atlanta. And, you know, I think when you go through a trauma like that together, that's a lifelong connection. We went on to marry other people and both have children and both have really beautiful lives.
And it is amazing that you were able to have children.
It was my first question. As they said, after I was stable, they said, well, you'll never walk again. And at barely 19 years old, I was like, well, can I still have children? And they said, yes. And that kind of gave me I knew then that I needed to go back to college and get a master's degree. I got married and I gave birth to three kids after, and they are now 28, 25, and 22.
Isn't that amazing?
It is.
And Karen is a physically beautiful person who was Miss Wheelchair America, Miss Wheelchair USA 2019. And you've had opportunities, but not the kind of opportunities that would have been available had this not happened. And yet I have talked with you many times. I know there's disappointment, but there doesn't appear to be a lot of bitterness about what happened.
No. I remember seeing him in the trial a year later, and I was considered a witness, so I could only go in for a minute. And he was in an orange jumpsuit with shackles, and he immediately started giving me like this intimidating stare down, which at that point I gave the intimidating stare down right back. And I thought, wow, like he doesn't get it. And being mad at him is futile, right? And it only wastes my time and energy. And I knew that from a really young age and finished college and got my master's degree and went on to a great career. And Miss Wheelchair America is an organization that's strictly based on your advocacy for people with disabilities and then your ability to articulate your platform. So thank you for the compliment. But
well, you have been able to, we've gone through Karen's story a few times, but you can stand for several minutes.
Only with, because I'm completely paralyzed from the weight down, so I have no movement or no feeling waist down, but there are standing robotic devices, and that was part of my platform, was getting devices that keep people with paralysis or other mobility impairments healthy. So that includes functional electrical stimulation bicycle I use, mm-hmm. and multiple standing devices. And through my job with New Motion, we sell custom wheelchairs. I've been able to advocate with a group from Washington, D.C., and we just had CMS open basically public comment on seat elevation for power chair users. So I've been able to take my experience and go to the legislators and you know try to get things improved for those in my community who can't speak for themselves or get to D.C.
877-217-5757 in our time with Karen Roy. And if you'd like to send an email, talk@talklouisiana.org. She is an amazing story, a survivor like few others. And some people, of course, would wallow in despair. And some would say that's perfectly natural considering what happened to you. Talk about being wrong place, wrong time. At 19 years old, with your whole life in front of you, you had to battle for your life. And then, of course, you had to go back to school and you were in a wheelchair. Mm-hmm. That had to be tough.
It was scary. I'm not going to lie. I do a podcast now. It's called Life Possible with a Disability, and you can find it on all of the podcast platforms, you know, Spotify, Apple, and you can watch it if you want to on YouTube. But I recently went to an adaptive fashion show, and I say all the time, like, I knew people at LSU were going to stare, and if they were going to stare, I was going to put on a cute outfit. it was petrifying, but it was what I wanted. And, you know, my parents weren't the kind that they let me, you know, go back to college, live in an apartment, fly to Europe, but they didn't let me sit around and wallow for long. And luckily, that's not my personality.
I'm getting a few emails, and we will take calls too. It is a sensitive topic, but for those who are brave enough to talk to this gallant lady, we welcome your input. 877-217-5757. Gaston in Mid-City, you're on with Karen Roy.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning. I wanted to ask, and I'm sure you've thought about this also, how can we amend the Second Amendment? I mean, it seems like we're all victims, not as bad as suffer as much as you, but we got to figure out something out.
Well, in this case, it was a handgun, mm-hmm. which are legal for law-abiding citizens. And I don't know of any movement on any side of the political spectrum right now to take away the rights for people to carry handguns. Now, unlike assault weapons where you can wipe out 20 or 30 people in a minute or two, handguns are different. And I don't know that there's an answer to this in a free society, but I'm sure you've thought about that a time or two.
Yeah, I'm not opposed to law-abiding citizens carrying guns. I own guns myself. So I don't I obviously don't have an answer to that. But, you know, when they fall into the wrong hands, obviously, and they do often, it's tragic, the consequences. But, you know, I am happy to be an American and have the right to defend myself and own a gun. That didn't change the day that I was shot in the back.
Clayton on Florida. Clayton, you're on. Please be brief. We're going to a break, but Clayton, you have the floor.
Good morning, Karen. I ran a bike shop here in Baton Rouge for many years. Yeah. You came in multiple times.
Yeah.
And you and another customer who was an amputee said the same thing that I've passed on to many customers, that life is not over, but it's definitely different. And that has changed people's outlook that were in a point of despair. So
thank you.
I just want to say I appreciate that.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you for your call, Clayton. Good call from Clayton. And we will return with more from Karen Roy after this 90-second pause. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Karen Roy is in the house. 35 years ago tonight, she was shot outside of Tabby's Blues Box, the longtime iconic night spot in downtown Baton Rouge, North Boulevard. I went there many times, never had a problem, but it is in a part of the city that is occasionally violent. And a few blocks away last Friday morning, 2:30, 21-year-old Allison Rice, an LSU student set to graduate in May, lost her life. And the assailants are at large. Now, Karen Roy's people were caught quickly. One in particular, the trigger man. How long did it take?
48 hours, like the show.
48 hours.
Mm-hmm. Well, they had the advantage of there was a lookout, and the other guy with the gun turned themselves in to plea bargain, and then that's how they found the shooter.
877-217-5757, and a listener, Holly in the Garden District, asked what happened to the person who shot you. Is he still in jail?
Yes, he is. I recently checked. So the trial was a jury trial, and he got 2 counts of armed robbery and attempted second-degree murder. So it's 99 for each count of armed robbery and 50 for attempted second-degree murder, so 248 total. He's been moved from Angola to a prison in North Louisiana, but yes, he's still there.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing how some people commit these heinous crimes and they get out in 10, 15 years. But in your case, the person is in jail. And I would think for something like this, he certainly should be.
Yeah.
877-217-5757. Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, you're on with Karen. Good morning.
Good morning. You know, something you really don't know what you miss when you don't have it anymore. Mm-hmm. And we had a ban on assault weapons, and it works. Bans do work.
Okay, well, this particular case has nothing to do with assault weapons. But what do you make of handguns? What do you think handguns should be criminalized?
They should be banned as well. They should be banned as well. We do not need them. Police need them. We don't. We need to ban guns and support women's right to choose. Thank you.
All right. Well, all guns, according to Phil. And there are people who share that point of view. And I recall when in the 1960s, when I was a small kid, when Jack Kennedy was shot, not by a handgun, but his brother was, Robert Kennedy, as was Martin Luther King was shot with a high-powered weapon as well. But Bobby Kennedy was shot with a handgun. There was an attempt, 2 of them, on Gerald Ford's life, the president who succeeded Richard Nixon, number 38. And George Wallace was seriously wounded, paralyzed as a result of a handgun. But that's a discussion that doesn't appear to be going anywhere. The question is about assault weapons. And Karen, who has lived to fight another day, believes in the Second Amendment to the point where you say you have weapons.
Yeah, I mean, I need to be able to protect myself and... Yeah, I mean, it's not a perfect solution, but I don't think that only the bad guys and the cops should have guns, in my opinion.
Now, a listener asked a good question, and I think it's been a while, but in one of your earlier iterations, like 10 years ago, you talked about the process of driving. Mm-hmm. So you can drive. You drove here this morning. You have a wheelchair. It takes, obviously, some maneuvering to do this and some dexterity, but you're able to do it and do it well.
Yeah. I use a manual wheelchair because, you know, my paralysis is just from the waist down. Get it in and out. I learned in rehab, so 35 years ago, to drive with hand controls. And so that's like nothing. So, I fly all over the country. It really hasn't slowed me down. I just don't do it standing up.
Now, on an airplane, you don't have any problems?
Luckily, my chair on Southwest airplanes, because they don't have first class, I can fit the chair on there and then transfer directly from my wheelchair to the seat. But it doesn't stop me from traveling anywhere I want to go.
How have you kept your outlook so beautifully conducted based on what happened?
You know, I focus on the things I'm grateful for, and that list is long. It's a long list of things to be grateful for. So, you can't control what happens to you. You can only control how you react to it. I know that sounds very cliche, but it's true.
And I'm sure when something like this story regarding Allison Rice occurs, you can't help but relive what happened to you.
Yeah, I mean, it makes me sick. You know, it breaks my heart. For her family, and I, you know, it vividly brings back memories, right? My three kids, she was their age. So that was a topic of conversation at our house, and, it's devastating. Mm-hmm.
Last time you were on this show, you talked about, your battle with bladder cancer, which is unfortunately something that happens a lot to people who are confined to wheelchairs.
So most of us have a neurogenic bladder, which means we have to do intermittent catheterization. So that constant irritation leads to bladder cancer, but it started a new advocacy vein for me, because for many, many years, DEHP, which is a carcinogen, is still a part of a lot of urological supplies at this point. And so I'm kind of in the nicest word I can say is discussion with manufacturers about mitigating that risk. But I'm doing well right now. We found it accidentally because of a kidney stone. And so we caught it early. I've been in treatment. Right now, there's no signs of it. So the treatment does last a total of like 2 years. So I'm not done, but I'm definitely, I'm planning mm-hmm. on kicking its butt and moving on. So.
It's radiation and chemo?
It is. So my doctor, Dr. McCall, shout out to him. He's amazing urologist here in town at Louisiana Urology. But so it's BCG. It's actually a form of tuberculosis, and they put it directly in your bladder. It's one of the only organs where you can put it directly on the site of the cancer, and it's actually an immunotherapy.
Well, I've known Karen for many years, and she inspires me every time I see her. And I remember back in the day, you were at Books a Million, and I'm sure he told you, but the former governor told me how much he admired you, Buddy Romer, who was a regular there. He commented more than once about how you inspired him.
Isn't that crazy? We're just like hanging out at Books a Million, me, you, and Buddy Romer. I think I was just doing my homework, and I was like, some important dudes in this room right now. Yeah.
Well, Buddy Romer, unfortunately for him, he did this between his loss in 91 and his defeat in 95. I remember he came in after that defeat in 95. He was not a happy camper, but he was always lifted by your presence, and who wouldn't be?
Wow.
So thanks for being you, and thanks for inspiring many of us, including the late former Governor Charles Elson Buddy Romer, who had an eye for beautiful women as well.
I will say, look, your kindness to me over the years and just it means so much to me. I think you remember the date before I do, which is like, we all know you're a savant as far as like numbers go, but I'm so glad you're my friend, and I'm so thankful for your friendship over the
years.
Well,
I am honored to be in your orbit. Thank you, Karen.
Thank you.
And now it's Scott Wilfong, veteran guest of this program, and Scott wearing another hat today. We know him as a Republican political consultant, but many may not be aware, Scott for many years has been on the Alcohol Beverage Control Board, and he is the chair. He is the head honcho.
I am.
And Scott, who, as we know, is extremely conservative, wants the bars to stay open longer, at least every now and then. So, Scott, some people are saying, what's gotten into him?
Well, it is. I am surprised at the reaction. I don't think people, like with a lot of news stories, really read what it's about. But we did. You know, I did have some council members talk to me after the LSU Southern game, and the traffic had just been so overwhelming that there were a number of businesses, bars and, mm-hmm. and other places that normally make most of their revenue from, say, 10 o'clock on a Saturday night till 2 a.m., just completely shut down. There was no way to get to them because the contraflow was blocking them. And when it finally did let up, what you saw was an influx of all these people, and so, especially around the campus bars. So everybody comes in, just to be blunt, a lot of college kids ready to drink at 1:30 in the morning, and they blast in there. And in 30 minutes, the bars have to say, okay, get out, hit the street, which, you know, I think some of the folks that don't understand it think it's been about more of a money grab for the bars. It's really, which we are about facilitating lawful commerce. We do want these establishments to make their money. And you know, there's a number of establishments in this town only open 2 days a week.
All right, hold tight. Yeah. Scott Wilfong, ABC chairman, on bars. Should they be open later in Baton Rouge? We'll talk about it when we return. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Scott Wilfong is in the house, the Republican political consultant who is chair of the Baton Rouge Parish, East Baton Rouge Parish Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. He says keeping bars open an hour later could alleviate gridlock at future home games for LSU. Mothers Against Drunk Driving have penned a letter in opposition to any proposal that keeps bars open later. Now, it sounds like, Scott, you believe this might be a good idea for any time, not just home games, if it were left up to Mr. Wilfong.
Well, it's, you know, as a consultant, you know, I wear one hat when I'm trying to message for a candidate. And so it is a little different paradigm when I'm, you know, I'm the chairman of the board. So I really kind of have an obligation to all my members who elect me, but then also to the council who appoints all of us. So there's a lot of moving parts when you have a situation like this. But I mean, I will say just personally, when I put my own views in it, I'm very libertarian, not just conservative. And in some ways, I think, why does government get involved in any? Why doesn't government tell Walmart when they should shut down? Why doesn't government tell a bicycle shop when they should shut down? But in this industry, they decide that, and they pick an arbitrary hour of 2 a.m. I don't know, you know. I mean, that young lady that got shot on Government Street, I think it was at 2:19 a.m. You know, the other morning. I mean, I don't know that you can draw a direct correlation between a closing hour and, you know, and a more dangerous thing for our community. But in this case, one of the arguments for this was it would create it only for a few days this fall. It would be 4 or 5 games. Then if there certainly is a movement in the parish to make that. Mm-hmm. 2 years ago, I was approached by an attorney for some of the industry that wanted to go to 4 a.m. And I said, well, you know, approach the council with it and whatever. But in the future, when this comes along and there's a desire to go to a more permanent thing, at least then we will have 3 or 4 data points of, you know, what did it look like after the Alabama game? What did it look like? And one of our members made a good point at the meeting last week. Not only would you have data points, you would have the most, you would have the system under the most stress. When Alabama lets out, if we see that it can be handled with a 3 a.m. closing time after Alabama, well, then a Tuesday night in March, it'd probably be okay as well. And again, I'm not necessarily advocating for it, but I understand that there's
sure
people
sounds,
that
sounds like it.
There's people that want it on both sides that really would like to see it happen.
Well, and this one is a bit murky because as it is now, if you leave an establishment at 2 o'clock, as I must say, I've done a few times.
No, not you.
Yeah, you know, you're out there at 2:15 with all kinds of people, some of whom shouldn't be on the road driving. It's a dangerous time to be on the road. Sometimes. You know, I get my steps in. Sometimes I'll take a walk.
I remember City Park, wasn't it, when you were accosted?
It wasn't at 2 o'clock, though.
Oh, okay.
It was early. It was only 10. But Bill Huey sent this even before you came on the show. He says, what a brilliant idea Scott Wilfong and the ABC board have come up with. We can't solve our traffic problems at LSU events despite dozens of overtime cops on the scene, so let's keep the bars open an extra hour. That way people who've been drinking since noon already can get absolutely smashed before attempting to drive home. Streets should be relatively clear by 3 a.m., putting only utility poles and the rare pedestrian at risk.
Well, it's a perfectly legitimate point of view to have. I just think that, you know, if it's going to be studied, first of all, we're not the final stop on this. You know, so this is a great civics lesson. I told people at the board meeting last week. We were the first step. Now it goes to the council. Everybody that lives in the parish has a council person that represents them. If you feel strongly one way or the other, call them. The council will make the final decision on this, and the citizens are having their input. And, you know, I think that's great. This is how government works.
Do you sense momentum going in your direction?
I mean, I think that there's I think there's a big movement on the council. I don't know if there's a majority of the council for it, but I do. I've spoken with a number of members, and I think that they're at least wanting to try it. Probably for what I just said, though, they would like to have some data before in the future. We know this is going to come up again as a permanent measure. If we don't know, I mean, I wouldn't feel comfortable just going, you know, blank check to 3 a.m. with no data, no studies. This is an opportunity to do that.
877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org. We'll start with James and Metairie in just a moment, but some people are sending emails, and I know some people are more comfortable doing that. And Scott Wilfong is a guy, as we know, who doesn't hold back no matter what he is talking about. Here's a good one, though, from Tracy at the Capitol, noting that about 15 years ago on this show, Daryl Orso, the councilman, was on. And he was talking about getting rid of the blue laws. Mm-hmm. You know, you couldn't even buy booze.
That's right.
On Sundays. Mm-hmm. And to think that the parish now is talking about 24-hour drinking establishments? Is that progress?
Daryl is a good friend of mine. He's president of my Rotary Club. And I remember at the time, it was the same reaction. Oh, my goodness, we're going to have chaos in the streets if we allow liquor to be sold on Sundays. Now, who thinks twice about it? If you need a six-pack before the Saints game, you go grab it. You know, I just don't think. And it's funny, the people that are so worried. I mean, I can tell you, I don't know when I've been out at 2 a.m. It's been a long, long time. Well, so, you know, if you're worried about the chaos, don't go out.
Recently married, and before Scott got married, he was working out like a wild man. And are you continuing that?
Oh, yeah, I'm leaving here to go work out right now.
All right. I like that. James and Metairie. James, good morning. You're on with Scott Wilfong.
Yeah, good morning, Jim and Scott. I have a question I've been wanting an answer for years. There are retail stores who advertise on the radio. There are alcoholic beverage outlets that sell beer by the six-pack or the case, liquor and spirits by the bottle. And the commercials claim that they are selling these items at the lowest price allowed by Louisiana law. Two questions. Are there really laws in Louisiana that establish these minimum prices for the for alcoholic beverages? And if true, those laws seem to be cost controls, violating free trade and conservative principles of government intrusion into free trade. Please provide us with an answer if these laws are there, and why are they there?
Well, they are not in the traditional sense of they're not legislation. Like, you can't go to the revised statutes and read it, but it falls under the creation of the state alcohol board, which regulates wholesalers. So, yes, if you're a bar or you're a packaged liquor store, you have to buy your alcohol from wholesalers, and the wholesalers are the ones who are regulated on the prices they can charge. They can't, Mockler Beverage can't sell you a 24-pack of Budweiser for $2. They have to have a minimum price. They're regulated by state ATC. And then actually the laws are even more intrusive than you would think. Like, we have laws in East Baton Rouge about when you can set drink specials and the times when you can reduce your prices down to a dollar. So, for instance, it's I believe, 40% of your regular menu price. So if your Budweiser is $5, you can discount it 40%, but not any more than that. Mm-hmm. The caller is right. It's not just that. There's a lot of restrictions on the pricing of alcohol and specials and things like that.
What all does the ABC board regulate?
Well, in East Baton Rouge, we license every Class A. An A license is a restaurant for consumption on premises. A B license is for package sales out the door. And then we do have a Class C license, which are for like the microbreweries and those type things. So we license all those, and then we have an enforcement arm that writes citations for violations, you know, everything from serving underage to unlicensed employees. And then if it's a serious enough offense, they'll have a hearing, and we're an administrative board that levies penalties for these type violations.
You've been on the board a while.
I was on from 03 to 11, went off, and came back on in 18, and I've been on since 2018.
And who appoints the board members?
The Metro Council.
Okay.
Yep.
877-217-5757 is your number. David in Atlanta. David, you're on with Scott Wilfong. Hi, David.
Good morning, gentlemen. You know, if people want to drink and guzzle all night and all day, to me, government shouldn't have to be a babysitter. But on the other hand, if the bars are going to be open longer, shouldn't the level of alcohol in a person's bloodstream be reduced, because there's slaughter on the highways by drunk drivers, which really concerns me and should concern everybody. Mm-hmm. You have the right to drink, but you don't have the right to drink and drive when you're loaded.
Yeah, that's a good point. Rarely did David and I agree on things, but that is one I can't argue with there. I mean, with every new freedom probably comes a little more accountability and responsibility, and so I think it wouldn't be a bad idea to study that. And again, that's what we're talking about is let's look at how it works and give an opportunity for law enforcement and the government to have some data.
Tom on Bluebonnet asks about your enthusiasm, if any, for the new Murphy's that will soon be reopening a block away from where it operated in 1997. A young man died there in a binge drinking incident, Benjamin Wendt. It's going to be on Chime Street. Is that a good thing?
I mean, I think every business, needs to have, well, again, I guess to go back to it, is there a personal accountability? Yes, there should be. I don't remember. I wasn't in Baton Rouge at the time that occurred, but as it seems like the young man was more than willing to participate in this binge drinking incident. And, I think there needs
fraternity thing.
I mean, it happens every so often and it's tragic, but, I don't, unless there was some overwhelming evidence that the business participated actively in this, then, I don't understand why a business needs to be shut down for the acts of an individual.
Well, when we had the 18-year-old drinking age, when I was in college, there were bars on campus. The union served beer. There was a place called the Pub in the basement of Hatcher Hall. Mm-hmm. And we had all these establishments right off campus, and we didn't have as many people driving to places because they could walk. And we also didn't have as many binge drinking incidents. When something is taboo, sometimes it makes it all the more attractive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, I think that's always going to be an issue. I mean, I went to college in the Midwest, and, I knew every 7 days a week there was somewhere you could go and get dollar beer. And that's what we that's what we went after. But there were binge drinking accidents on my campus, and it will always.
This is at Champaign, Urbana,
Champaign,
Illinois.
That's right.
Right.
We never drank champagne, but we did drink a lot of beer in that town.
Really?
Oh yeah, it was a great place.
And you came from Ruston, where you couldn't buy a beer if you wanted to, right?
Right. But I'm old enough that until I was 19, I was still in on the, like, when I turned 18 in Ruston for the summer before I went to college, I could drink. I could go to the bars and drink as an 18-year-old.
They actually had bars open in Lincoln
They did
Parish?
Around Louisiana Tech. There were a couple. But, it was only beer. Like, you couldn't go get a shot of whiskey or anything.
All right. Stewart Downtown is next when we return. 877-217-5757, your number. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number. Scott Wilfong with us for a few more moments. And he is proposing that bars stay open to 3 a.m. on nights that LSU or Southern play a football game in the parish. It kicks off after 5. The resolution, which the board approved as amended on a 4-3 vote, will require the parish metro council support to become the law of the city. 877-217-5757. Stewart Downtown. Stewart, you're on with Scott. Good morning.
Thank you, Jim. Scott, the audience. Good morning. Mr. Wilfong, why are so many? Will you share the philosophy as to why so many liquor stores exist in the proverbial hood in the inner city, littering these neighborhoods and facilitating alcoholism, drugism, crime, stuff like that. Yet you don't see the same thing in more progressive white neighborhoods. Do you guys ever discuss this topic? It's disgusting, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I mean, we have actually. One of our councilwomen, Chauna Banks, has come multiple times to the board, and I commend her for her efforts for that. She was in the news recently about a liquor store up in her district that was attracting a lot of crime and a lot of, problems in the community. And that's, we've had council members over the years that have tried to address that. I mean, sadly, I guess it's just, it's just supply and demand. I guess that's where it's, packaged liquor is, there's just not a demand for fine dining in these areas. There's a demand for cheap liquor available at all hours, and that's wherever that demand is, someone will find a way to get up there and make money off of it. So I think it's just a profit driven thing, and until something happens and there mm-hmm. gets to be more opportunity and a safer area and all that, I think you've got to have a deeper conversation.
But if someone wanted to open a liquor store across from Bocage, I suspect there would be a tremendous opposition from the residents of that area.
Well, there could, but there was Churchill's across from Bocage for many years.
Across, it was down the street. Well,
okay, but I'm just saying, you know, I mean,
of course, they tried to open in another part of town and didn't have success, but they're back.
Right. Yeah, they're Churchill's is back, but yeah, it's just, you know, it's different. Poverty is probably the root cause of it all. When there's not any opportunity and there's a lot of unemployed folks that don't have jobs, and I guess all unemployed folks don't have jobs, but it leads to crime and leads to, you know, a bad thing. And people with means get out of those areas and they don't come back. And that's, you know, I've had a lot of talks with a good friend of mine, Tony Clayton, the DA in West Baton Rouge. And we've talked about, you know, how to solve those kind of problems with, you know, because as the Black community, as they become successful, they leave as well. You know, a successful, there's not any successful people left in Scotlandville hardly, or Park Forest that have become wealthy, because once they become wealthy, they vacate and move to another area and what's left. So I don't really, I wish I had the answer. I'd run for Congress.
Well, I'm sure that is in the offing at some point, but Scott, we will catch up with you on the political front, I hope soon. And the election is getting close. As we know, November 8th is getting closer and closer. Let's see, 11 days left in September, 31 in October. That's 42 plus 8, 50 days away.
You're stressing
me out. 5-0, 7 weeks from tomorrow. So that's, we right. will be in touch, Scott Wilfong. Thank you.
Thanks, Jim.
Always good. Kathy Saloy is with us. She's the Senior Vice President of Community and Economic Development for Hope Enterprise Corporation, based in New Orleans. She is working to expand Hope's small business initiatives with a focus on growth and business development through outreach to a range of community and economic development entities, determining eligibility and financial report management. So she is doing her best to close what is called the racial wealth gap, something that Scott was alluding to. And good morning to you, Kathy.
Good morning. Happy to be here this morning.
This is a big topic, and it has a lot of tentacles, but what's the best place to start to get where you would like, and I think most of us would want our city, our state, and our country to be?
Exactly. So we want to talk about our emergency capital investment program and what it can do for our communities. If I can start off just talking a little bit about HOPE. So HOPE Enterprise Corporation, HOPE Credit Union, is a financial institution, and we provide financial services that aggregates resources and really engages in advocacy to mitigate the extent to which factors exist, such as race, gender, birthplace, and wealth limit on one's ability to prosper. So HOPE is a community development financial institution. What that means is we play an important role in generating economic growth and opportunity in some of the nation's most distressed communities. And so I'd like to focus on some emergency capital investments that we received and what it can do, you know, for our communities, if I could.
Kathy Saloy is with us, Senior Vice President of Community and Economic Development for HOPE Enterprise Corporation, which is based in New Orleans, 877-217-5757. You referred to the Capital Investment Program. This is a U.S. Treasury Department initiative. And how is HOPE tied to that?
So HOPE is tied to the Emergency Capital Investment Program, and I'll call it ESIP for short, where on June 28th, HOPE received $92.6 million, and this is in secondary capital. And again, that was received from the U.S. Treasury Department. So as secondary capital, these funds will position HOPE to support between $700 million to $1 billion in deposits. And those funds are going to be used to invest in homeowners, business owners, communities, families, and individuals throughout the Deep South. So that will afford us to do loans over the next 10 years. We estimate that we're going to do about $150,000 of loans. I'm sorry, we're going to do more than 150,000. We'll serve more than 150,000 people over the next 10 years. And those funds will be invested directly in the Deep South. We service course, Louisiana. I'm based out of New Orleans, but we service Louisiana, Alabama, Arkansas, Memphis, Tennessee, and of course, Mississippi.
Well, how can Black-owned smaller businesses, Kathy, in the Delta, in the Black Belt, throughout the Deep South, how can they get assistance?
Sure. So I'm glad you asked that. So, you know, with these dollars, again, this is going to be used for funding sources. But being a community development financial institution, we specifically focus on how we can provide access to capital for our small businesses, unlike what you can do through traditional lending sources. So these funds will be specifically invested into loan funds where we will make it affordable and easier for businesses to access capital that they need to scale their businesses and to make an impact in the communities that they serve.
Well, in the South, as we know, we have a larger percentage of Black Americans than any other region, and yet politically we're the most conservative, primarily because Blacks are voting for Democrats and whites by huge numbers are voting for Republicans. But there is this gap in wealth as well, and it is evident perhaps more so in the South than in other regions. How definitive is that gap in the South, the racial wealth gap?
So we know that there is really a large racial wealth gap. And so that is, you know, what HOPE does. So with these funds, we are building on our history and our focus of being present and having relationships in low income and underserved communities. HOPE will leverage this ESEF investment to exponentially increase the volume of affordable banking products. Mm-hmm. That'll be to consumers, for mortgages, for small businesses, and for community development efforts so that we can better meet those needs, because we know that there is a large racial wealth gap. And we, you know, one of our missions is to change that paradigm of poverty and to, you know, to help to support building generational wealth.
In the South, as in other regions, but really in the South, it's more prominent. There are a lot of poor white people as well. And there are more people in this country on welfare who are white than there are Black people, because we have a preponderance of white citizens when we nationally review the population. But as far as numbers, do you have numbers about what an average family of color the net worth is in the South compared to an average white family?
You know, through our Policy Institute, I know we would have that information, but I do not want to misquote that. But we know that that does exist. And so we know that the communities that we serve are primarily Black and brown, but we are, you know, we serve any residents that are in those communities. And so, We welcome and we have a diverse membership, but you know, again, we know that it's more Black and brown residents. But I don't have those specific numbers. I'd be happy to follow up with that.
All right, where should we go if we're interested in what you've been discussing this morning, Kathy?
Sure, there is a lot more information on the ESAP program and how you can participate in our transformational deposits. You can go to our website at www.hopecu.org. That's www.hopecu.org.
We're short on time, but a listener asks about the problems in New Orleans. There are a few. It's still the crown jewel of Louisiana, but how significant are the problems right now?
So, you know, this will definitely benefit the people in New Orleans. We know that there's many challenges that we face. We need to increase wages. We need to increase minority contracts, you know, rebuilding from hurricanes, housing challenges. And these resources can definitely assist with that.
We do have to roll. But thank you, Kathy Saloy. Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services and Jerry Lane Chevrolet. Until tomorrow, stay safe and stay tuned.